Welcome to the Hometown Hero Outdoors Podcast.
All right, we're back with episode 3 of the Hometown Hero Outdoors Podcast, hosted by myself, Daniel Meyer, and then we've got Chris Tatrell, our vice president, on as well. Tonight's a pretty good episode. You know, last time we kind of talked about introducing the founders, what the organization does, and then we also met all of the rest of the board members. And then tonight we have Craig or Tourette's Cop on with us to kind of share his story and, you know, his life as a law enforcement officer. So, Craig, you want to introduce yourself, kind of what you do, and
yeah,
go from there.
Like Daniel said, my name is Craig. I've been a police officer for 11 years now, and I have Tourette syndrome. So those noises that you hear are me, and that's just part of the disorder. So Tourette syndrome is a genetic neurological disorder that causes involuntary vocalizations and physical movements. So in layman's terms, I make noises and move around.
Very cool. Yeah, no, so Craig and I go back a decade now, where when I was stationed in Isle, Minnesota on Mille Lacs Lake as a conservation officer, Craig was a local law enforcement officer in Isle doing part-time work. And at that point in time, Craig's always had Tourette's. But at that time, your Tourette's is not that prevalent. Like, you didn't have
right.
The tics that you're currently showing at this time, right?
Right, yeah. And yeah, those didn't start until after I decided to quit smoking. So it was a few years ago now. I'd been smoking ever since I was 18. And you know, back then, my tics weren't as severe or as noticeable as they are now. So when I started smoking at 18, they just gradually just kept decreasing and decreasing in frequency, to where, you know, I would pretty much forget I had Tourette's, and nobody really noticed them because the movements were so infrequent that, you know, they could just be easily passed off as anything. So I decided to quit smoking, and I used the Nicorette gum to kind of help curb the cravings and get me to quit. And that was working wonderfully. And I was down to just one piece a day. And at that point, I'm like, you know, am I chewing this gum because it's actually helping, or am I just chewing it for the sake of chewing gum? So I stopped using it. And it was 3 days later. I remember this like it was yesterday. I was down in Nebraska visiting some friends at the time, and I woke up one morning, and it was like the floodgates opened for my motor tics. They were constant. They were nonstop, and I was concerned at that point. I was like, well, this is new, you know. So, I mean, by the end of that first day, I was icing like my elbows and my neck just because of the amount of pain that they put me in, just because, you know, my body wasn't used to those, that frequent of movements. So about 2 or 3 weeks later, after that, my vocal tics started coming out, and the first one I had was a really loud kind of cough or a huff, and a couple other ones. So at that point, I was now very concerned, and I decided to make an appointment with my neurologist. And prior to that appointment, I was on the phone with my mom, and you know, she had asked me, it's like, do you think your tics coming back has anything to do with you quitting smoking? You know, at that point, a little light bulb in my head went off, and I was like, you know what? Never thought of that. Probably. And that's exactly what the neurologist said. You know, Tourette's affects people differently. Nicotine affects people differently. And so for me, it had suppressed my tics for all those years that I was smoking. And, you know, once I, you know, got the nicotine out of my body, it just opened up the floodgates for my tics.
Yeah. And then Did you ever have the thought, like, since you that clicked in your head, like, hey, it was the nicotine that was suppressing my tics, that you were going to pick up smoking again or just fight through it?
You know, so that's exactly what my neurologist had said. It's like, you know, maybe, you know, start using the patch or start chewing the gum again. And, you know, at the time I was like, you know, it took a lot for me to quit smoking this time. I don't want to start it again. But then unfortunately, you know, a few months later, I started smoking again anyways. And it didn't do anything.
Didn't matter.
Didn't matter. It looks like it was a one and done type of thing. So
it was here to stay.
Yep. Exactly.
So I met you in 2012, 2013. You didn't have the tics as much. You were kind of born and raised in that area in Isle. And I know that you had said that a little bit more of a hereditary type thing, right?
Yep.
With Rett syndrome. So someone in your family?
Yeah. So it came from my dad's side of the family. My dad has a very slight tic disorder, but I have uncles and cousins that have, you know, anything from, you know, like minor tics all the way up to Tourette syndrome. And some of my cousins are actually more severe than I am. And they take some pretty hefty medication just to kind of lead a normal life. So, you know, when I started ticking back when I was a little kid, you know, 6-7 years old, my parents knew exactly what it was. Like they weren't concerned about it. They didn't freak out about it. You know, so like I never went to the neurologist and got diagnosed because they knew what it was. And, you know, it wasn't interfering with my life or school. So yeah, there's like, why spend money for a doctor to tell us what we already know?
Right.
You know, so like I ended up not getting diagnosed until, you know, just a few years ago in my 30s, because I actually started going to neurologist.
Yeah. And then, so obviously, like when you started your law enforcement career, like Chris said, you know, back in 2012, 2013, didn't really show any signs of Tourette's. And it was, you know, a thing that you knew that you had. Did you feel that you had to like hide that, you know, throughout the application process, or was the, or were they pretty accepting of it, seeing that you're still able to perform all the duties that were needed?
So like when I got into law enforcement back in 2008, you know, I rarely was ticking. So I didn't feel a need to bring it up because it wasn't something that was prevalent or prominent, you know, noticeably or just within myself. And it wasn't until, I think it was 2017.
Yeah, because you went to the oil fields, right?
Yep. That oil fields was 2014 to 2016.
And then, yeah, because there's a couple years that we didn't see each other.
Yeah.
And you came back.
After I came back.
Right.
And I think right as I came back, I think you had already gone to where you are now.
Right. Yeah. I transferred to a new station. And you had gone back to IOPD at that point. And that's when some of, I know, our partners in IO mentioned that your Tourette's kicked in pretty good.
Yeah. So, you know, so like my first few jobs, you know, applying, it wasn't an issue. So when my tics came back, like I said, I was working for IO, and I had to have that conversation with the chief, obviously, you know, just to let him know, it's like, this is the new me.
Yeah.
And, you know, his biggest concern and just like mine was just to make sure I was still able to do the job. And thankfully I was.
Yeah.
You know, for myself and for a lot of people with Tourette syndrome, when you're intently focused on something, your tics go away. They take the back burner and you stop ticking, during that time. You know, so for me in regards to the job, you know, anytime going to a substantial call, anytime a weapon is out, and, you know, anytime I'm kind of, you know, dealing with the public in general, my tics take the back burner and I don't tick.
Yeah.
So
I've seen that been like one of the biggest questions that you get on social media that you respond to quite frequently, right. Is like, how do you handle a weapon, or, you know, deal with those stressful calls? And it's always the same answer, you know, when a weapon's out or you're dealing with that sort of situation, that ticks kind of suppress, and then, you know, once the adrenaline wears off, they come back.
And you know, it's not even necessarily the adrenaline, you know, because it could be like, I could be playing a video game, or, you know, like doing a hobby I'm very interested in, and I'm focused on that. My tics will stop, you know, during that time, and then come back when I, you know, when I stop doing that.
Hey, buddy. Puppy.
he saw someone walking by.
Well, and so I know, like, going back to our friendship and the time that we hung out too, is, you know, when your tics are elevated, you know, when we're together, we'll throw on some video games or Xbox or whatnot.
Right.
You know, and you start playing like that Ghost Recon or whatnot, and like your tics go away completely.
Yeah.
But you're so intently focused on that game and what's happening, like in a neurological sense, that your brain transitions into focusing on that and just kind of dissipates everything else.
Yep, exactly. You know, and that during those times, like, I don't even realize or notice that I'm not ticking, because again, I'm so focused on what's happening in front of me, you know. And a lot of times I won't know that I'm not ticking until someone says that I'm not ticking, and then that makes me start to tick.
Yeah, right. Well, and there's times too where I do notice, you know, that when your ticks are elevated, you know, either it's a handful of different things. Maybe you're stressed out, have a little something else going on. Maybe it's your unexplained pain that you get, or it's hot out, that type of stuff. You know, like, some, because your body naturally, you run a little warmer than most, right?
Yeah, and I think a lot of that is due to me constantly moving.
Right.
You know, that just kind of just raises my internal temperature, which just makes me just kind of run hotter than normal people.
And therefore, your metabolism is a lot better than mine, so I hate you.
Yeah, I'm not going to complain about that.
Well, I mean, it's a unique thing, you know, and not something that everyone encounters. So, like, just walk us through, like, a traffic stop. Like, what does that look like when you talk to someone?
You know, surprisingly, I don't recall a single traffic stop where someone has asked me about my tics. Generally, it's I'm on another call, you know, whether it be, you know, a domestic or move unwanted or even a medical. That's when I get the most questions, you know, and those range from, you know, just however comfortable that person is, you know, they'll straight up just be like, "What's wrong with you? You know, what do you got going on? Do you need some water? What's that noise?" I mean, just something. And
or be Chris Herman.
Oh, Chris, yeah.
You good, bro? You good?
Yeah, exactly.
our treasure. I'll tell that story when you're done with yours.
Yeah. But you know, so I get those questions, and I'm not embarrassed or get angry at those questions. I don't shy away from them. I just, you know, just very confidently tell them, it's like, I have Tourette syndrome. I make noises and move around. It's my normal. And then I move on. You know, I don't make my tics an issue, because I'm there for another reason.
Right.
And if they have any more questions, you know, when the call is over, I'm more than happy to answer them for them. But, you know, while I'm there, I'm obviously there to do my job, and then that's what I do.
That's cool. So, kind of a transition too. You're a pretty big outdoors person.
Absolutely.
What is it that you enjoy doing in the outdoors?
My biggest passion would be waterfowl hunting, duck and goose hunting.
So you know, a sicka freak or what?
I am not, but also I own some sicka gear, but not a lot.
Well, but not a whole closet full of it.
Yeah, exactly. That means you're not a sicka freak. If you're a sicka freak, you own all of it, so you're good.
Yeah, no. I think I want a pair of gloves and some pants. That's it. Because I don't want to pay those prices. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. So what's your bread and butter? Is it duck hunting or goose? Or?
You know, I like both of them equally. You know, I like goose hunting because, you know, you're going out to a field, you know, early in the morning when it's dark out, you know, you're setting up your blinds, you're setting up all the goose decoys and, you know, judging by, you know, which way the wind is going, how to set up your spread. And then it's just, it's peaceful, you know, because there's always that, that calm or that lull in your day, you know, after you get done setting up and before regular or before hunting hours. And it's just something that I enjoy, just being able to watch the sunrise, you know, over your spread or just, you know, out in the field that you're in, you know. And the same thing with you know, duck hunting, you know, out on the water. It's just, I mean, to me, it's peaceful. I mean, this, the whole process, the whole thing is peaceful to me. And, you know, just be able to go out with your friends and be able to chat with your friends and just be able to get away from it all and just enjoy being outdoors.
Yeah.
I absolutely love it.
Yeah. Waterfowl hunting, you know, it's never really been my bread and butter at all. You know, I mostly got exposed to it when I became a game warden. And
okay.
It's just not my thing, you know, and the super early cold, wet mornings, man, I can't, it's just, I got to get out and check people for work and that's great, but man, it's not my thing.
It makes sure. Your job a little bit more difficult.
Sure.
Yeah.
But sure. Duck opener for you is probably one of the early seasons that you've got to get up for.
Yeah. It's an early morning. It's usually two or three in the morning. You know, people are crazy about waterfowl hunting. If you got a good spot, you know, they'll go set up the day before and spend the night on the water. And
right. Yeah. Especially on state land where it's first come.
Yeah. You know, so you get out there and you start checking people and you're like, "Where'd you get here?" "Well, I've been here since 2 o'clock yesterday afternoon." I'm like, "You've been here for 24 hours. Wow. Wow." You know, but I mean, people love it and I can't fault them for that. We all have our own niche, you know? So.
Right. Well, then for me, I mean, since my ticks came back, really, really can't, deer hunt because I can't be quiet.
Yeah. You're not the quiet guy in the woods.
Yeah, exactly. The deer will know where I'm at.
Being a sniper is not your quite forte in that situation, right?
Exactly. You know, and then again, that's another reason why, you know, I love waterfowl hunting is you don't need to be quiet. You can chit chat with your friends that are literally, you know, standing or laying down right next to you and you can shoot more than once.
Right. Yep. Yeah. Put Craig in a ghillie suit and in the woods.
Yeah, you'll be able.
Why is that bush making noise?
Yeah, why does that bush keep moving?
And then is there... Is there any other outdoor stuff that you do? I know when we all met up, I think it was last year during our banquet time, you brought everyone some maple syrup and then you
did
some farming on the side too, right?
Yeah. So, you know, in the spring, you know, just itching to be able to get outside and spend time outside when it's actually, you know, halfway decent out. Me and a friend of Chris and I's, Noah, will tap maple trees for maple syrup. And we do, I mean, generally we do a substantial amount. I mean, we'll boil down enough sap to get anywhere from 12 to 20 gallons of syrup. So, I mean, that's thousands of gallons, I think.
Well,
it's
you guys 50, are
50 to 1 generally.
Okay. And you guys have a better soil content when it comes to the average of your sap to syrup. I think average is 50 to 1, but I think the region that you live in is generally like 30 to 40 to 1.
Yeah, we've noticed there on because we have a couple properties that we collect the sap from. And we do notice some properties, the trees there will produce better than trees in, say, other properties. And kind of closer to Mille Lacs, we've noticed we've had a lot better luck, I guess you could say, in collecting just the amount of sap and just, yeah, and also just the sugar quality or sugar quantity of the sap.
Content goes up. And that's as you get closer to the lake, you think, or?
Yeah, because... we have two properties that are right next to the lake. One is they're both literally like there's the lake and then here's the road. And that's where we collect all our sap from. And those two properties are usually our best properties for collecting.
So when you guys collect, you tap the trees, you collect the sap. You get them in the barrels. Then what's the process after that?
It is a really simple but long process. So, yeah, we'll collect the sap from the properties, and then we dump them into a large kind of holding tank. We have a like a 250-gallon holding tank where we, collect a couple of days worth, and then we'll start cooking it down. And like I said, the process for making maple syrup is very simple. We use wood to boil the sap, and that is literally all you do. You just keep like adding.
You got to use a stainless steel pan, though, right?
Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. We have a stainless steel pan, and we actually had some custom made 2-foot by 4-foot and fairly shallow, just because it cooks it a lot quicker and just more surface area to boil. And then we get it down to, it's starting to turn more of that golden color. And then we take it out of those pans and put it into a stainless steel another stainless steel pan, and we put that on a turkey boiler, and that's, we can control the temperature a lot better there. And then we use a what's it called, a hydrometer,
yeah,
to check the sugar content. And then when so we get
tell
it
you
to
the ratio, yeah,
yep, so we get it to where we need it to be, and then we filter it to get rid of as much sugar sand as possible, and then we can it.
And sugar sand, that's just a content or a byproduct when you boil it down that just kind of, it'll settle in the bottom, but you use like a cheesecloth filter.
So we use cheesecloth on the top because that collects the majority of it. And then that goes then into a felt filter, which is a lot finer to collect or to make sure we get everything.
All that sand.
Yep.
Yeah, you gotta be really. Impurities. Yeah, you gotta be really careful when you're finishing that product, because if you go a little too high in temperature and you let it cool, it'll turn all into actual crystals.
It'll crystallize if you go a little bit over what you're supposed to go on.
Yeah,
it'll crystallize. It could potentially burn, or it just where we stop it also the consistency of the syrup as well. The longer you cook it. The less water is in it, the more syrupy it is.
Right. Well, and one thing I noticed when I was up there, I used to do some maple syruping myself, was, you start to have a couple beers when you start cooking the syrup, and then all of a sudden 2 beers is 8 beers, then it's 10 beers, and then it turns into a long day.
Yep, and then it's 3 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, and then you wake up and everything is either burnt or turned into crystals.
And it seems like syrup season in Minnesota, I'm sure everywhere else that it's pretty popular. It turns into like a big friend group thing. You know, people post on Facebook like, hey, come boil syrup with us.
Yeah, one of the big things we did when I was up there was we would I'd get all the guys, Dan Mott, Noah, some other law enforcement up there, and we'd go out on Mille Lacs and we'd go tulipy fishing, and we would get our limit of tulipy, and we'd go back, brine them up, and then we'd do our maple syrup collection, a sap, and then we would, the same day that we were actually boiling down maple syrup, we would be smoking our tulipy in the smoker, so we could preserve them and then be able to freeze them for later if needed. But that was kind of our deal, and we went through a lot of bush days.
Oh yeah. Well, then I mean, after a while, it just kind of turns into kind of a tradition that you do. You always know, come springtime, it's syrup season, and it's just kind of a tradition that Noah and I have.
Yeah. Well, I still got probably 2 gallons of your syrup sitting in my pantry. So we go through as fast as we can. I mean, I got 7 kids here, so we go through pretty quick.
Squad of a family.
Yeah.
Right.
We go through. We love that stuff. It's so good.
Right. And I think, cooking it over a wood fire kind of infuses just a little bit of a smoky flavor to it as well, which I really enjoy.
Yeah. There's some crazy setups people have up there too. Some of those sugar shacks, they have these evaporators.
Yeah.
And they literally have like these trees that are connected with tubes. And these tubes are all vacuum or gravity fed, where they will drain to one central location. They'll collect that and they bring it to their sugar shack, elevate it. And then it does a slow drip into their evaporator, and it goes through one side, and as it cascades down to the end, it'll come out with syrup on one end. And these guys are going through, they're making what, 200-300 gallons of syrup a season?
Oh, geez, yeah. Crazy. I mean, that's big operations. Too fancy for me.
That's a lot. I mean, that's pretty intense. That's a lot of investment, but I mean,
yeah.
I mean, if that's your thing and your family likes to do it, I mean, it's a good pastime.
Oh, absolutely.
Well, you also do some farming up in, where is it? Thief River Falls?
The Crookston area.
Crookston.
Yeah. So just east of, Grand Forks.
Sugar beets.
Yep. Sugar beets. So every fall I know a family up there that's it's a family run farm, third generation. And yeah, every year I go up there and either drive tractor or drive truck for them.
Was that a thing that you've kind of always been doing, or what made you decide that farm is a good hobby for you?
Or, well, I've always loved driving
extra pay.
Right. I've always loved driving big machinery, and I've known this family for years. And one year I was up there and they asked if I'd be willing to help, and I said yes, and I've been kind of doing it every year since. It's been going on for 6-7 years, I think.
Is that it? I thought it was longer.
I think I skipped a few years every once in a while, or skipped a year in between a couple. But I think it was like when I was in the oil field, 2014, 2000 to 2016, I didn't help at all. And I can't remember if I
got to get that oil money.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, when I first started, actually, and up until last year, they put me in the defoliator. And what that is it's driven by a tractor, and I would just top the beets, you know, so the beets have the big green leaves on them. And what this would do is it has drums with spinning rubber and metal blades, and it would take the green off, and then at the very end it would just cut the very, very top of the beet off, kind of exposing the white flesh. So sugar beets are white, they're not red like everybody that plants them in their garden. And what that does is it exposes the beets then for the lifter to come in and lift the beets up out of the ground and then put them into a truck. And the defoliator goes very, very slow, generally 2 to 2.5 miles an hour.
That's a long day.
Oh yeah, our shifts would be anywhere from like 15 to 18 hours.
Wow.
You know, because
sitting in a tractor all day long.
Yeah, well, it's got GPS, so all I got to do is just hit my straight line, and the tractor drives itself. So I just got to make sure that nothing is breaking or anything like that. So I just turn on Netflix and just kind of watch shows or listen to music. Because awesome. One of their fields is a mile long.
Wow!
So going 2.5 miles an hour in a mile long field, it takes a hot minute.
I had family. I still have family in Grand Forks, and a lot of them did work around sugar beets and stuff like that. And I'll never forget, like, driving into Grand Forks and smelling those things, man.
Yep,
that was the worst smell ever.
You get used to it.
Yeah, like, don't they, like, you could put them in big piles, and eventually, like, all of like the juices and stuff that are in them, like, kind of secrete down on the ground. They got these massive like ponds of beet juice.
Oh yeah, that probably gross. Smells wonderful.
It's terrible. It's terrible. Well, that's cool. Well, we know that, you know, you and I go back to some small town copping up in Isle. A little bit of a unique thing, you know, and one thing I think is kind of interesting about small town copping is everybody knows everyone, and everyone knows your business.
Exactly.
So what are some of the trials, tribulations, or things that you experience in a small town that not could be a positive or could be a negative?
Well, I think everyone knowing everyone is both a positive and a negative. You know, a positive because sometimes it helps you on calls because everybody knows everybody. You know, you
right.
can, you know, ask someone, it's like, hey, I'm looking for so-and-so. Oh yeah, they're, you know, down at this street now, or, oh, they moved and they're living over here, or, you know, they just, people know. And also at the same time, it's a negative because of the exact same thing. You know, it could be, you know, so-and-so is mad at someone else. They know they have warrants, so they want to get that person in trouble.
People throwing each other under the bus constantly. Yeah.
Yes.
Did you ever experience, I know Chris has told me quite a bit whenever he was working up there, you know, people just like coming by your house, like he did, just to ask questions or file a complaint or whatever the reason may have been.
Luckily, that didn't happen too much. I only lived up in the Isle area for probably about 2 or 3 years. And after that, I lived away from town.
Yeah.
So I only had, you know, maybe one or two times where someone would actually come to the house and
right.
talk to me. And I think that's different because generally there's another cop in town that they can talk to. Whereas, you know, Chris, he's the only game warden in the area. And yeah, once they find out where you live.
Oh man, game on. Yeah.
Yep.
Man, I'll never forget, like, my first week I had people in my driveway. I'd be going outside to like fill up the wood boiler, you know, to heat the house for the day. And I'm in my boxers and person in my backyard, 6 a.m. Hey, you the game warden? I'm like, God dang, man. I'm like, it's 6 a.m. You know, I'm just in my boxers, just trying to put firewood in my furnace. Leave me alone.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's different. It's really different being a small town cop. But,
yep.
You know, I had, I'll never forget too, the UPS guy that we had. His name is Brian. He was phenomenal. Great UPS guy. But Brian was very in tune with being a UPS driver. And I'll never forget, one day he opened my front door to put a package in there. He didn't like what he found on the other side of that door. I'm like, you just don't let yourself into a cop's house and not expect something on the other side.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
But it was nice though. I moved out of town a little further away. People still drive by to say hi or see what I was doing, or even if I was home. But then I got further away down towards Mora. You know, and there's a lot less of it. People going out of their way to look for me down there. But
right.
I mean, I'd have to hide my squad or my truck, you know, just to make sure people knew I wasn't home. Or
right. And I guess that was one of the positives for me is we didn't have take home squads. So you never saw a squad car in the driveway unless I was, you know, stopping at home to grab something or get something to eat.
Yeah, you know, it's small town. Policing is great. It's tough to some extent, too. I mean, there's people throwing each other under the bus constantly, but sometimes the politics are tough, you know, since people do know everyone. And
well, that and you're closer to the politics,
right?
You know, like in larger departments, there's still politics.
Right.
But you're so much further removed from it, you know, compared to a small town that, you know, you don't hear about it as often.
Right.
You know, like in a small town, you don't have, you know, a chief deputy, sergeant, captain or anything like that. It's the chief and then the officers.
Right.
You know, so it's you're a lot closer to, you know, hearing all the issues and things like that. You know, whereas a larger department, there's a longer chain of command that, you know, it can potentially go through or be buffered from where, yeah, you just don't really hear it.
Well, it brings up two different things too for that area. You know, an aisle, you're on the northeast side of Mille Lacs County and then the southwest corner of Aiken County and then the northwest corner of Kanabec County. So it's kind of a very diverse area. And the county seats for each county are pretty far away at that point.
Right.
So a lot of the issues kind of tend to congregate in that corner because there's less police activity in that area.
Right.
So for that corner or that tri-county area, you know, the closest law enforcement was either ILPD or us as state game wardens.
Right.
So we end up taking a lot of those calls, you know, and sometimes our closest backup is, you know, 40 minutes away. There's times where I've been on calls and ILPD was my closest backup, and that was a half an hour.
Right.
You know, so yeah. It was very interesting to be dependent on each other in different agencies where I might be in a completely different county, 20 miles east of Isle, but you guys are my closest backup, and I had to make sure our relationship was good. So you guys were coming to help me when I needed you. And I know I backed you on a few calls, you know, when we were there.
Yep.
And,
oh, absolutely.
You know, it's just... I think... Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to just say, you know, and also working in a small town, especially in Isle, just again, because of where it's at in the county with backup being so far away, you know, I learned early on how to talk to people and how to talk to people well.
Right.
You know, just because, I mean, and I tell a lot of new people this, like, you know, the most important tool in our arsenal is our voice. You know, 100%. With backup being, you know, 10, 15 minutes away minimum, you got to be able to talk to someone, you know, just to be able to keep the peace and keep everybody safe.
Yeah. Don't want to be the aggressor when, you know, escalating the situation and making it, you know, more dangerous for yourself and the people that you're interacting with at that time.
Well, right. And everyone up there in that area has got guns too.
Yeah.
You know?
And
oh, exactly.
You know, how you talk to them, and you know where you're going, you know, they're going to jail.
Yep.
But you gotta be able to
de-escalate,
like,
the whole situation.
Yeah. Step back a little bit. Slowly work your way to that process until your backup's close.
Right. Yeah. Cause I remember, one winter, I assisted Mille Lacs County on a call. So they were on the other side of the lake up by the res, and an assault came out, at Bayview. And, it was like, a male was assaulting a female, females on the ground. So I was the closest person, and I was probably 10 minutes away. So as I'm getting there, you know, dispatch says, you know, both the male and the female are getting into a pickup. Well, just as I'm coming up to the parking lot for the bar, I see that pickup. Now, this bar is located right on the shores of Mille Lacs Lake. And they have and like I said, this was winter. So they had a lake access right there. So they had a road plowed out onto the lake. So I can actually say I got into a pursuit on Mille Lacs Lake. You know, not a lot of cops can say that.
No.
But anyways, it was a fairly short. He turned a corner, ended up spinning out and getting his vehicle stuck. Long story short, I ended up fighting with this individual. I went hands on with him for probably over 8 minutes. Because again, the county was still on the other side of the lake. So they were racing over to get to me, but it's still quite a drive to go from the res around the lake and then down to Bayview where I was at.
Right.
And to put that into perspective, Mille Lacs Lake is, I don't know how many.
Exactly. It's 132,000 acres.
Yeah.
So yeah.
It's one of Minnesota's largest lakes, right?
Yeah. I think it's 62 miles around.
Yeah. It's pretty big. If you were to go in a boat from the southeast corner to the northwest corner, so from Isle to Garrison, and you go full speed at 40 to 50 miles an hour, it still takes about an hour to get across the lake.
Yeah.
So, and that's on a good day. That's not a non-wavy day.
Yeah, that's not when there's 2-foot rollers.
Yeah. Hey, so we know that you started your social media career, and I think when you were in Isle, you started off with the old application called Vine.
Oh, had a Vine account back in the day.
Oh yeah, man, that was his jam.
I did. Yeah. That was like the taste of social media.
Ma'am, put the shovel down. That's not what I meant. Your direct video.
Yes.
So talk about your social media presence. Like, so you're the Tourette's cop, right? So you're part of humanizing the badge. You're trying to let people know who you are, and what medical situation you're living with, as well as being a cop. You know, talk about your social media stuff, as well as the your journey with, you know, humanizing the badge and what you're trying to do.
Okay. So you both know who Officer Daniels is.
Yep. We do. Tell our listeners who he is.
So Officer Daniels was kind of the beginning of law enforcement on social media. He started his social media career on Vine and got very, very popular there. And that's actually where I ended up meeting Officer Daniels, was through Vine. So we had been friends, you know, since 2013, 2014, whenever Vine was. So the end of 2018, you know, I was pretty comfortable with my ticks at that point. And he had approached me and said, you know, you should start social media. You know, having Tourette syndrome and being a police officer is kind of a, you know, a unique situation. And, you know, I was kind of hesitant, you know, at first. I mean, that just, I mean, to me, that just, that seems scary, you know, to be able to put yourself out there for, you know, the world to see. I didn't know if I was ready for that. So he had told me to think about it. And I did. You know, I just kind of weighed out the pros and cons, and obviously the pros, you know, far outweighed the cons. You know, to be able to bring awareness and education to a disorder that's rarely talked about or that people are misinformed of, to humanize a badge, to show people that, you know, there's a person behind that uniform. You know, we all go through issues, we overcome those issues, and also to, you know, instill confidence in kids and to let them know that, you know, a life with Tourette syndrome doesn't have to be miserable. You can still, you know, excel and live life to the fullest while having Tourette's. So it was January of 2019. I started my social media career as Tourette's Cop. And I mean, since day one, I've just been totally blown away by the feedback that I've gotten from it. You know, just the messages and comments from parents, you know, just telling me that, you know, they gave them hope for their child, you know, because their child may be the only person that they know who has Tourette syndrome, you know, and they just didn't know what kind of life that their child would be able to live, you know, with the disorder, and seeing somebody that's in law enforcement and excelling at it while having Tourette syndrome, you know, just kind of, you know, gave them a huge sigh of relief. And that's kind of, you know, I mean, one of the big reasons why I continue to do this is just, again, just to be able to show parents and kids that you can do whatever you want, regardless of Tourette syndrome.
Right. Yeah. I think that's huge, you know, for, you know, a kid or even a young adult that maybe doesn't see, you know, someone like them going through the exact same thing. You know, I imagine that you can get pretty down on yourself, be like, well, you know, I'm not going to be able to do the things I want to do in life. And then having someone like you that's, you know, pretty big on social media, has a good following, being successful, right. That, yeah, kind of gives them hope.
Yeah. I mean, Tourette syndrome is, I would just say it's kind of a lonely disorder. You know, it's common throughout the world, but, you know, like, I was the only person in my school that had Tourette syndrome. And a lot of these kids are, you know, they may be the only person in their entire school that has Tourette syndrome. So they don't have anybody they can relate to. They don't have anybody that can, you know, understand the thoughts and feelings that they have regarding Tourette's and just, you know, some of the issues that come with it, you know, and yeah, you know, so seeing, you know, someone on social media that's excelling and, you know, letting them know that they can do whatever they want. It's, like I said, it's why I continue doing it. And that's why I love doing it.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And go ahead, Chris.
Your platform has reached quite a few different people across the world.
Yeah,
like, don't you have the UK and Australia?
Yep, I've talked to people from Sweden, Brazil, the UK, Ireland, New Zealand, Portugal. I mean, it's just, I mean, never in a million years did I ever think that I would be talking to people literally from around the world.
Right. Well, that's pretty unique. And then you've done a few interviews too, I think. Combat Bet was one that you recently did. Who is the podcast you just recently worked with too?
I just did a podcast with Street Cop Training.
Street Cop Dennis. Training.
Yep.
A news interview too?
Yep. I was, I did a news interview for a TV station in Portugal. Actually, that was one of the first things that I ever did because of my social media. And then
Portugal, that's cool.
In yeah, Portugal, that's, yeah.
That's wild.
And then a Fox News station out of Michigan. I did an interview for them as well.
And wasn't there another large name one too? Sorry, Dan.
Oh, nope.
Wasn't there another large network with anchor that you were chatting with?
I did an Instagram live with an individual that works for the news, and I'm trying to think.
Majority of the time, you know, these aren't people that you're reaching out to saying, hey, you know, I'd like to come on. They're people that hear your story from, you know, seeing you on social media or maybe someone they know and seeing the impact that you have, and then they reach out to you and set that up.
Yep, exactly. I have never reached out to someone to have them interview me. I just think that just sounds weird, and yeah. I would never do that.
So since we're on that topic, if anyone ever wants to interview me, I am more than open to have interviews. I will meet you remotely or in person if I can.
He'll fly to you. He prefers warm destinations. Yes. So like Florida.
Yeah. Just a shameless plug right there.
Yeah. Well, and you did Back in the Blue Line. So you were the keynote speaker for Back in the Blue Line, which is a nonprofit here in Minnesota. So Back in the Blue Line is a group of law enforcement spouses or supporters, and they assist with law enforcement officers who may have encountered an injury or having some type of difficulties. And you got to be a keynote speaker for them recently, right?
Yep. That was on May 21st. And again, I remember that because that's the day my neck pain came back.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So that was
yeah. Fun. Just happened to go away for a little bit until you had some pressure on you.
Yeah. Yep, exactly. But no, it was a great night. Met a lot of amazing people. And I'd be more than happy to do that again.
Yeah. No, and then, you know, back on the... So we talked kind of about some of the, you know, a lot of the positive stuff with the, you know, putting yourself out there on social media. And I know, you know, from all the law enforcement officers that I know, they make sure that they hide their identity on Facebook and stuff. Has there been any kickback that you've got from coworkers or, you know, the general public of you just being such a well-known name in the law enforcement community?
No, not at all. I mean, none of my coworkers have, you know, they don't have anything negative to say about it. I mean, a lot of them, you know, see it as a positive. And then the community in general, I've never heard or seen anything negative in regards to my social media presence, you know, and then being in a small town, you know, like I don't advertise myself. I think that would be weird. But, you know, again, working in a small town, word travels fast. So it only took 2 or 3 months before it started getting around that, you know, quote unquote, Tretz cop was working for, you know, the city they live in.
Yeah. So you're not one of those social media influencers that's got like your Instagram handle, TikTok name, like on your back window.
Not even a little.
Well, he keeps crashing those vehicles into deer, so he it get expensive.
Yeah, exactly. That's a lot of vinyl. But
what are you on your going on your third vehicle from a deer now? Two cars, and now you just got a third vehicle to start. Hopefully,
just got a third vehicle. Yeah. So
what's the timeline on that? On all that taking place? Like,
so the end of June 2021, I hit two deer with my little Ford Focus ST, and then this year, beginning of June, I hit one deer with the car that I had. Both of them got totaled.
I think it's a trend with people that we know. You know, we've got Dale with Rogue Productions. In like a month, he's had four people hit his car.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah.
That's miserable.
Yeah, pretty bad.
Yeah, especially with car prices the way they are right now. Like, I was, like, when I crashed, when I hit those two deer back in 2021, I just had this, you know, like, little beater farm car. And I'm just like, I'm going to drive that because I am not paying car prices what they are now. I'm just like, I'll just drive this car, you know, car prices should go down in a couple of years. Well, then I crashed that car, and it's like, well, now I have to buy something.
And now we have 30% inflation on used vehicles. This is wonderful.
Yes. Oh my goodness.
Yeah, see, it seems like now you can sell your car back to the dealer, what you bought it for, you paid for it 3-4 years
ago. Get more
ago.
Back. Yeah. Get more money
yeah, exactly.
Back.
Well, that's what a lot of people are saying. You know, they're just like, oh, I can sell my truck for more than I paid for it. I was like, yeah, but then you have to buy another vehicle for more than what it's worth.
Yeah,
right. Unless you buy a scooter.
Yeah, exactly. Or a bicycle. You
look like that Dumb and Dumber movie. Yeah,
a little moped.
Yeah. Yeah.
You just be like one of those cops that are in like the UK rolling around on a Segway.
Right. Heck
yeah. Yeah, that, just get your helmet with the light on it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I personally would be the siren.
With your ticks.
Yep, exactly. People just hear that and like, huh?
Yeah, right. Well, very cool. No, I know you've been involved with some of the HHO events and stuff that we do. You've been to our barbecue, I think, a couple times.
Yep, two years now. Yeah, 2020, 20 and 21.
And that's for the Minnesota chapter. We usually annually host a barbecue event at the Big Marine Veteran Rest Camp, which is a facility that is a nonprofit that allows for veterans to have a mobile home or rent a cabin there. It's a beautiful piece of land. And each year we host a barbecue there that is more of a meet and greet. Anyone's welcome. You don't have to be a veteran to be there. You know, everyone's welcome. Come out and have a good day and do some barbecue, meet everyone, shake some hands, maybe get involved in a silent auction or a beanbag tournament for cornhole. Was it 2 summers ago where we had that tornado almost hit us?
No, there? That was last year.
Was it last year? It's 2 years ago now. Cause last year I was at the fire in Ely. So it's been 2 years.
Yeah, it was summer after I left Minnesota.
Golf ball size hail.
Oh, I think there's baseball size there.
It was ridiculous.
Yeah.
And we're all standing out there by the pavilion. We're like, oh, we'll be good. You know, doing the dad thing, you know, staring at the sky, wondering where the tornado is.
Right.
That's the most Midwest thing ever. Like, oh, there's a tornado coming. Let's go sit out in the garage.
Let's go crack a beer and watch.
Yeah.
That was
as everyone's getting pelted.
And that was the biggest hail I have ever seen in my life.
It was pretty crazy.
It was. That was wild.
And we had a tornado touchdown probably half a mile north of us.
No big deal.
Right.
Just as soon as it started, it was over.
It was crazy.
It was pretty quick. And then it was just humid.
Yeah.
Because I mean it was warm already that day, and then we had all of that rain come down and
right, then it worse.
Cleared up, got sunny, and it just got grossly humid.
Yeah.
It's certainly fun to have you show up to our events and meet some people and
love going to them. It's a lot of fun. And
back to that story with Chris Irvin.
Oh, treasure.
So Chris has never met Craig Trescott before. Chris Irvin's our treasurer. Love the guy. And they're sitting at the same picnic table, and Craig's got his ticks going, doing what you guys hear right now. And we got Chris Irvin over there just staring at him. Like he's got a thumb growing out of his forehead or something. He's just staring at him, making noise, doing his ticks. And Chris Irvin looks at him and goes, "You good, dude?" And what did you say back? You're like, "Yeah, I got Tourette's."
Yeah, that's usually my go-to answer. I mean, just like it's quick, it's simple, it's to the point. And generally people know at least, you know, what Tourette syndrome is.
Right.
You know, so then, that it's for him, it was just, yeah.
You good, bro? You good, bro?
Yeah.
That was hilarious.
Oh, yeah.
Well, cool. Dan?
So, you know, I think in my opinion, I'm sure Chris can attest to this. I think for the people that we serve, the law enforcement community is definitely one of the most cautious groups of individuals, you know, as far as it, you know, get involved, even with just, you know, signing up to go on trips with us and whatnot. Have you got any advice for them? You know, just take that leap and try something out that's going to benefit them. There's no hidden agenda behind it, right?
Yeah, 100%. If you love the outdoors, if you love hunting, fishing, I mean, just anything outdoor related, like Hometown Hero Outdoors is definitely an organization I would trust. Because, yeah, I mean, yeah, there's no hidden agenda. It's just literally like, come out and do this.
Yeah.
You know, just get away from it at all. Connect with people with the same interests. You know, just decompress. You don't have to, you know, live, breathe, and think about work 24/7. You can just get away from it all and just enjoy the great outdoors with like-minded people.
Yeah.
And we're pretty cautious people to begin with, law enforcement. You know, I was military before and went to law enforcement, and I think I became more cautious. But you know, when you're military, you know, and you deploy, you know, you're with your group in your gang that you hang out with day in, day out. But when you come home, you know, at the end of your shift, it's you. You know, I mean, you got coworkers right. and everything, but you go home and you peel that uniform off. You know, you might it's have just encountered you. Something, you know, yeah, pretty extensive, and it's just you. You know, so. Like one example I like to share is, you know, there's a day that, you know, I got into an altercation with an individual and almost had the guy was twice my size and I pulled my taser and, I went home after work and had to go to a birthday party, you know, and, I had to take that uniform off and go to this birthday party and try to be a normal person who interacted with society. Even though I felt like I almost got my ass kicked 10 minutes ago.
Yeah. Right. I'm sure it's like anything else. You know, you feel like you probably don't want to burden, you know, your family and friends with the things that you go through on shift, you know, daily. So, you know, being able to connect with people that have experienced that same stuff and understand like, hey, this guy just needs a vent. Like if he wants to talk about it, cool. You know, let it out. Or if it's just a matter of hanging out, being next to someone that has been there before.
Yep.
Yeah, it's different. It's a different animal, you know, being able to take off that hat and go on with normal life. It's easier for some than most, you know, I had not to get dark and deep, but you know, I know we're coming up at an hour here, but, when I was in Isle, you know, I lost two really good friends when I was in Isle, you know, and I was one of the first responders on both of those situations. You know, one guy was in a car accident. It was my friend laying there dying. And then the other one was a suicide. You know, guy put a bullet through his own head due to some issues he had. You know, he took his own life, you know, and I was the first one there. You know, so I didn't experience that kind of trauma in the military. You know, that was different, you know. So then I had to go peel that uniform off and go on with my day, you know, and then you go to a small town funeral and you have to look at the people that, you know, are there to trust you and you're a pillar in their life as law enforcement, you know, and not only for the family and being the first person there to be that pillar, it's difficult. So I think that, you know, my message, and I'm sure Craig can attest, is, you know, if you're law enforcement, there is a lot of realities that translate to your military career that we can help relate with, even if you weren't military or you're strictly law enforcement or vice versa. A lot of things that are very similar.
Yep, exactly. You know, and you know, kind of in that same vein, you know, I've noticed the shift from, you know, when I first started law enforcement back in 2008, you know, there was still that mentality of, this is what we signed up for. You got to be a rock. You just bury, you know, those situations that you've been into, just bury them down. Don't talk about them. And, you know, now it's more going towards, you know, mental health for law enforcement and for military. You know, it's like, yes, we signed up for this, but like, we shouldn't
compartmentalize. Just
carry it. Yeah. We shouldn't carry it ourselves. We should be able to talk about it. You know, it's, we may not be fine with some of the things that we've witnessed and we should be able to talk about it with somebody.
Yeah, I know. Go ahead.
Well, I was saying, I've noticed that positive shift, you know, in the last few years. And I love seeing that. I mean, that's something that should have always been a thing, you know, but it's starting out. I mean, it's still not where it needs to be, but I mean, at least it's a start, and that's what I love to see. And I love to see more and more departments take mental health from their officers more seriously by offering services that they can go to if they need to.
Totally.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I've seen it in the military too, you know, not saying by any means that, you know, all of the older leaders are bad or anything, but you know, they were brought up under the stigma of, you know, if you have mental health issues, you're useless to us.
Right.
So we're gonna ostracize you and, you know, kind of just make you seem like you're lesser. But you know, as the younger generation kind of steps into these roles and they've seen the effects that it had on those, the older generation, and then the middle ground group of law enforcement and military, you know, right. I think there's a much bigger emphasis. And then there's more and more organizations like HHO, Humanizing the Badge, that are there to support, that are outside of the department or the military. So that way, yep. You know, we don't even have to tell, you know, the department or the military when we are going through some stuff.
It's getting better at being more normalized.
Yeah.
Yes.
And the resources and outreach is a lot better. It's getting there.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. We've got a long ways to go, but improvements better than staying where we were.
Yep, exactly.
Well, we're at an hour. You know, Craig, we really appreciate you coming on and talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we'll have you on again, you know, down the road. Hopefully we can have you some new events. We can do some live podcasts with you. But for our listeners out there, please feel free to look up Craig. Tourette's Cop is his handle on Facebook and Instagram. Also TikTok, right?
Yep, yep.
Yep, so... And YouTube. So he's got a lot of good content out there that talks about his Tourette syndrome, as well as some of the things that he experiences in life with his Tourette's. Dan Myers' dog also has Tourette's, if you haven't heard it. In the last hour.
He's over here doing the screaming. So.
Thanks very much for being on, dude. And I really appreciate your friendship, and thank you for the support that you give to HHO. And we look forward to the future with being friends.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thanks for having me on. And I love everything HHO is about, and I'm glad to be a part of it. And very happy for our friendship and just being able to do the things that we've done as friends and with HHO.
Absolutely.
Any last remarks, Dan?
No, we appreciate you coming on, Craig. Just, you know, Chris nailed that one on the head. And we appreciate all our listeners tuning in. Make sure you go follow Craig Tourette's Cop on all the social media accounts, and we'll see you guys next episode.
Thank you.
Bye.
For more information about Hometown Hero Outdoors, visit our webpage at www.hometownherooutdoors.org.